I caught up with Naomi Klein this week in Paris. Here's a conversation. Well, Naomi Klein, welcome to The Elephant.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
I wanted to start off by raising a point that you made yesterday on Democracy Now!, which I think was a really good one. And you said that social movements are about changing what is politically possible, and we need to make what is physically necessary politically possible. And I think that's such a great point, because it suddenly drove home to me just kind of how absurd this current situation we're in, where those two things can somehow not be in line. I was wondering if you could just comment on that, what that says, that somehow what we need to have be done, what is physically necessary for there not to be disaster, is still not politically possible.
Yeah, I mean, this is the great untenability of our current moment on Earth, where, you know, every interview I did yesterday with the corporate press asked me what was realistic. And, you know, and that's the way that world is trained to think. And their definition of realism is, you know, what can politicians get through their, you know, various political structures at home, you know, what idea is considered too radical. My idea of what is politically realistic is like what will sustain human life on this planet. And, you know, the idea of allowing temperatures to increase by 3 degrees Celsius, which is what these pledges collectively will bring us to. And the same people are telling us that it's not realistic for that to be legally enforceable. So that means, well, anything can happen. It could be 4 degrees, it could be 6 degrees if it's not legally enforceable. So that is called realism in our current structure, but that is intensely radical and dangerous, and utterly unrealistic in terms of any kind of, you know, stable society. So we are in this moment where what is considered realistic, centrist, conservative is highly, highly radical, actually. And what is actually, you know, just in line with the laws of nature is considered, you know, unthinkable, radical, impossible.
So how far would you say we have to go until we're at the point where it's politically possible to do what we need to do?
Well, I think for starters, the neoliberal project is completely incompatible with serious action on climate change, right? You know, one of the things that happened on the first day of the summit is Bill Gates stole the show and announced that he was helping marshal all of this private money and public money to invest in the quest for an energy miracle, right? This is Bill Gates's sort of obsession that we need huge amounts of money spent on R&D, looking for a miracle that will create the breakthrough technology that will unleash a huge amount of private potential, right? So his model is, you know, is really the internet, right? Like the public money that's spent building the internet, right, which is basically a project of the Pentagon, then is privatized by players like Microsoft and Google and so on, and they create the next big wave of capitalism. So what's interesting about that is it takes for granted that existing technologies are of no use, right? Or of very little use. And so, you know, we could invest massively in public transit, for instance, and that would lower our emissions. But there, you know, there's no discussion of that because that's not considered realistic. So it's considered more realistic to invest in notional technologies than it is to invest in existing public infrastructure, because we just don't do that anymore, right?
And public transit somehow isn't as sexy as inventing fusion or some.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think that just highlights just how incompatible our current system that that is constantly starving and belittling the public sphere, public services that serve average people, anything that decentralizes economic power and fetishizes this billionaire class, private profit, private entrepreneurial potential, and here they're openly calling for scarce public dollars to go into that model as opposed to, you know, a tried and tested public model. So you know, I don't think just challenging neoliberalism is enough, but I do think that it's kind of what we need to get to the starting point. I also think we need to challenge our growth-based economic system, because we obviously need to contract the role of consumption in our economy. It isn't just about those technologies. We're going to burn a lot of carbon in order to get off fossil fuels. And so, you know, the way our current system is built is that money will just go into consumption, and emissions could very well go up, even as we invest in renewable energy and transit.
You point out in the book that, you know, to stay under 2 degrees, we're now looking at, because we've procrastinated for so long, something like 8 to 10% in emissions reductions a year, which is a huge transformation. But you make an interesting point about World War II, in that suddenly we mobilized the resources, we did things that were potentially before culturally not seen as acceptable, even things like rations or women working in the workforce. Could you just talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that 8 to 10 figure comes from the Tyndall Center on Climate Change Research, which is, you know, one of the world's leading research centers. It comes from Kevin Anderson, who's deputy director of the Tyndall Center. He's here in Paris and, you know, probably the world's leading expert on radical emission reductions. And I think it's important to, you know, to point out that this is, you know, these are not my numbers. These numbers come from the Tyndall Center, and nobody has disputed them. Nobody has disputed them. You know, it's just an inconvenient, a truly inconvenient truth, right? And Kevin is always pointing out that there is a conservatism even in the climate research community, even among climate scientists, where, you know, they too are locked within this neoliberal framework. And so even as they raise the scientific alarm, you know, Kevin points out that they're often unwilling to follow their research to its logical conclusions, right? So they soft pedal the implications of this for our economy. But the precedent, the World War II precedent, you know, I think is a really important one, because it shows that economies can be transformed very, very quickly. In North America and in England during World War II, you saw a complete transformation in how people moved themselves around, right? So there was in some cases more than a 90% increase in use of public transit. Leisure driving just completely disappeared. People didn't just go for a drive anymore because they were rationing the use of petrol. And another example is the Marshall Plan, is the rebuilding post-war and the transformations that happened. The limits of that analogy are that it's an entirely top-down approach. It's the state declaring an emergency and imposing measures on society. It was important that those measures be perceived as fair. I mean, one of the things I look at in the book is that people are willing to embrace rationing if it's imposed in a way that is perceived as fair. And in particular, you know, that the wealthy also have to ration. And, you know, it's significant that in Great Britain and in the United States, corporations were virulently opposed to many of these measures, and the governments introduced it anyway. But, you know, the problem with climate change is that first of all, the times have changed so much. So, you know, this is such a challenge. That was a Keynesian time, and, you know, we are not in a Keynesian time, so this seems unthinkable. But also just that, you know, corporations did benefit from those big public investments. And responding to climate change is going to mean a redistribution of wealth in a way that is, I think, so threatening. And that, I think, is where the analogy breaks down. In the book, I also talk about the New Deal as probably a better analogy, in terms of it not just being a top-down solution in the sense that the New Deal was a product of huge pressure from below. And then, you know, the New Deal was a compromise, right? You know, in a deeply imperfect compromise. But I think that that's a much better analogy for the kind of conditions that are going to produce a low-carbon, a justice-based low-carbon transition than wartime rationing, which was just sort of like state edict. And I don't think we want that. Like, I don't think we want, you know, transformation by state edict. And I think if we had it at this stage in history, it would be a disaster and it wouldn't actually serve the majority of people. But I think if you look at the kinds of economic transformations that happened in North America in the midst of the Great Depression, you know, it shows what a very, very mobilized population can produce in combination with governments that, you know, are to some extent receptive to pressure to a large extent.
I think reading that example specifically about World War II gave me kind of a bit of hope and despair at the same time, because on the one hand, it's like, okay, great, things can really change quickly. But on the other hand, it's strange because, you know, war, I feel like it produces this visceral response. We saw that with, like, the Paris attacks recently, which is obviously a tragic thing, but it doesn't threaten the whole world like climate change does. And yet climate change doesn't inspire that same sort of urgency, that visceral response. You think it could?
I think it could. I don't think it's ever received the crisis levels of treatment. I mean, like, I think what you see with the Paris attacks is that what gets declared an emergency is subjective, right? You know, and this is not about belittling the attacks in any way, but why does an event like that catalyze transformation, but an event like Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy not become the same kind of catalyst? It could be the same kind of wake-up.
And what don't you think it has been so far? Why have those two been so different in their reactions?
Because of what I was saying earlier, in the sense that, you know, if you look at the way in which a terror attack catalyzes change and the nature of the change it catalyzes, right? It's a kind of change that serves elite interests very, very well. Restrictions on civil liberties, privacy, and, you know, it unleashes a huge amount of public money that serves private interests, the whole sort of private surveillance state. And you know, we saw it after September 11th, and this is what I, you know, wrote about in a huge amount of detail in the Shock Doctrine, of, you know, how there was a boom in what I call the disaster capitalism complex. Whereas if we were to respond with that kind of force after, you know, whether it's a, you know, a heat wave or in the midst of, I mean, what's to stop Obama from saying, look at what is happening in California with the drought and the impact on agriculture. This is an emergency. This is telling us we need to change. This is what we're going to do. Those changes would, you know, if they're real, if they're really going to bring down our emissions, they would be incredibly threatening to our elites. They would require massive investments in the public sphere that would benefit the majority of people, that would, it would have to be financed with increases in taxes. There's no other way it's going to happen. You would have to be imposing tough regulations on corporations and telling them that they're not going to be getting new oil and gas leases on public lands. It would be restricting new fossil fuel frontiers. I mean, all of this, there would be a revolt, right? A corporate revolt. So, you know, I don't think we know what it looks like for, we know what it looks like for politicians to make speeches saying climate change is the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. In fact, we hear nothing but here in Paris right now. But those statements are completely out of alignment with what those same governments are actually doing in the real world. The public takes their cues from media, from leaders. So, you know, if a terror attack pivots to none of you are safe, you know, we have to do all of these things to keep you safe, right? Then people say, wow, like, this really is transformative. There's nothing preventing the same thing from happening in response to the reality of climate change right now. Like, we don't need more bad things to happen in order for leaders to actually do that. You know, 2015 is the hottest year on record. 2014 was the hottest year on record. You know, whether Hurricane Sandy, you know, Typhoon Haiyan, I mean, whatever it is, like, I definitely do not believe we have to wait for things to get better before we can declare an emergency. There is no shortage of
things to get worse.
No. And, you know, there are some people who sort of say that, oh, things haven't gotten bad enough. No, things are very bad. We don't connect the dots between them. You know, we could even be doing that in relation to the Syrian drought and the way it catalyzed the outbreak of civil war and the connection with the refugee crisis. There's no shortage of emergencies in the way climate change is playing out. There is an absolute cognitive dissonance between the discourse around climate change and the kinds of reactions. When people see that, when people see this huge dissonance between the discourse and the response, they basically tune out, because it doesn't add up, you know. But this is why, you know, it does matter, I think, in Paris, that marches and demonstrations are banned, because, you know, these huge, you know, displays in the streets, right, when you have like 400,000 people,
it helps close that distance.
It does. But even, I mean, literally, these are our tools for declaring a people's emergency. Like, you know, and people use that, you know, phrase a lot in the streets the other day of you know, the l'état d'urgence. Like, this is, like, we are in a state of emergency, and it is not only the François Hollande's definition of a state of emergency, and exposing that subjectivity around, you know, what gets declared an emergency, what gets the emergency treatment.
You said what's stopping Obama from treating it like a crisis. And I would say, you know, this program is called The Elephant because climate change is the elephant in the room. And I feel like the elephant in the room of climate change is the Republican Party. Because I read a poll even just yesterday in the New York Times that said even a majority of Republican voters are in favor of putting limits on carbon emissions by power plants, mm-hmm. which is incredible given the positions of all the presidential Republican candidates at the moment. It seems you pointed out that we need to fix the democratic deficit if we're going to solve the climate crisis. This seems particularly a big problem in America, and it seems like we have a lot of work to do. Could you just talk about that? I mean, that seems to be a really gigantic problem.
It is, and certainly when I talk about these issues in the United States, that's what comes up, you know, most often, is people sense that, you know, nothing is possible in a political system in which the Koch brothers can spend more than, you know, either the Democrats or the Republicans in the next presidential cycle as they're planning to. And it's always worth remembering that the Koch brothers' money comes from fossil fuels. They're the largest leaseholders in the Alberta tar sands. So, you know, they're heavily invested in blocking action. And then you have, you know, Donald Trump and just you know, people seeing the way in which you can just buy your way into a presidential, you know, candidacy. So absolutely, you know, I called the book "This Changes Everything" because once you start looking deeply at this issue, it does, you know, it has this domino effect on, like, okay, well, this is broken and that's broken. Before we can do this, we have to deal with that. And